Hi guys, just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Seif Boynton, all about the world's worst law, a little message from Ben and myself. At this point, usually before the show, we would put in a little update on what we've been up to and ask you, as ever, to keep supporting the podcast in whatever way you can, be that donating on Patreon or following us on Twitter or writing reviews and giving us ratings on iTunes and all of that stuff. But this week we are taking a moment and reflecting on the horrific murder of George Floyd in America and the subsequent protests and demonstrations and widespread reaffirmation of the fact that Black lives matter, and sadly, Black people are not valued by the so-called systems of governance and law and order in America, and not just in America, here in the UK and in Ireland and around the world. What happens to George Floyd happens to far too many Black men and Black women and Black trans people, and is a symptom of a society and a world that has yet to confront some of its darkest moments and darkest sides, and has allowed racism and bigotry and hatred to fester and ferment and to rise again and again and again. And the only consolation is the widespread revulsion in the wake of the murder of George Floyd and indeed Breonna Taylor and the death of Beli Mujinga here in the UK, and so many other cases that we couldn't mention, has been matched by a huge surge in energy and self-reflection and determination in America and around the world. Ben and I, and I'm sure many of you, have been doing a lot of listening and reading and learning this week, recognizing that we have not done as much as we should do to educate ourselves on the problems that Black people go through day in, day out, and to educate ourselves on the systems and structures that we take for granted, which may actually be constricting rather than freeing. Indeed, in the upcoming episode you're about to listen to, towards the end, we talk about the Three-Fifths Compromise and the recent protests in America. And that's just one little bit of learning that we have been doing this week. We've been posting other resources, which I'm sure you have seen shared elsewhere on the Worst Foot Forward Twitter site, at Worst Foot. And we have also decided that as a podcast, we are going to donate our Patreon income for the month just gone to three different organizations supporting Black people. So we are going to donate to the National Bail Fund in the USA, the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, and here in the UK to Black Pride UK, as a recognition that we, indeed all of us, can do a lot better, that it's not just enough to be not racist, that we need to be actively anti-racist and confront problems that we may find uncomfortable and difficult to admit and to deal with. We hope you will do the same if you haven't already. If you have any presence in the social media world, there are countless different places that you can donate to support Black movements. You can support Black businesses. You can take the opportunity that lockdown has provided to order some books and then become more acquainted with the history of the struggles that Black people have had to face and the possible solutions and ways out. You can do your own research, but if you're looking for some suggestions, I myself have ordered Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, David Olusoga's Black and British, A Forgotten History, Rennie Edo Lodge's Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, and Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. If you feel like you should be reading more and learning more, why not pick one of those? Why not pick all of those and join us and so many people around the world in trying to be better people to each other. If you yourselves want to also make individual donations, if you're not a Patreon donor, and you, or indeed if you are and you want to follow us, you can visit the websites for those three organisations or the countless other organisations which are working actively to improve the lives of Black people in America, in Britain and around the world. That's it for now. We are but a mere humble comedy podcast, and we hope you will get a few laughs and smiles from the upcoming episode. But the news from America was so deeply affecting and so unignorable, and that's a horrible thing to recognize, that so many of these stories before now have gone ignored. It feels very much like this is a tipping point, and we at Worst Foot Forward are going to do our best to be better. We recognize that we're a podcast with two white guys presenting it, and we certainly have a as Ben would say, a solid but could do better rating in terms of representing Black people and other minorities on the broadcast, and indeed that's also something we're going to try and work at being better at in the coming weeks and months. So please, if you do want to get in touch and recommend Black voices particularly, and other minority voices that you feel that we do not represent often enough on the podcast, then please do. You can tweet us, you can send us a message on Facebook if you look up Westwood Forward, or you can send an email to westwoodforwardpodcast@gmail.com. That's it for now. We hope you're all staying safe. Be kind to each other and enjoy the show. And once more, Black Lives Matter. Hello and welcome to Worstwood Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxday, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. Order, 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 please, order. Please, please order. I've got other tables waiting, so hurry up and order. I'll be forced to bang my gavel in your bread basket. And I don't mean that bread basket. And alongside me is the judge to my Judy, the jury to my Ian and the Blockheads, and the executioner to my no, I said I wanted elocution lessons. Damn my poor enunciation. It's Ben van der Velde.
Hello there, my jurisprudential friends. I don't know about you, but I sort of feel that we finally made it to a podcast about the world's worst law as possibly two men whose parents would really prefer them to have been lawyers. This is the closest we'll ever get. I don't know about your mum and dad, but mine when I was young were like, rabbi? And then when that clearly wasn't going to happen, it was like, lawyer. Yeah. And now it's just gainfully employed and married well.
Oh, well, I mean, for the listeners at home, I am wearing a gown and wig, but not those ones. Much to the disappointment of my parents. I had a teacher tell me in secondary school, because in Ireland you'd sort of choose your... as I'm sure in most countries around the world, you choose your secondary school higher exam subjects sort of a couple of years beforehand. So I chose to do, in Ireland, you have to do Irish, you have to do English, you have to do maths and a modern language. So I was doing French. And then you can do two or three other or four other extra subjects. So I chose to do history, Latin and music, all serving me very well. And I was taken aside by both the head of business and the head of science to go, you're not choosing a science subject, you're not choosing a business subject. And I was 16 or something, like, because, you know, you could do those subjects. I know, but I don't want to.
Yeah, I had when I was choosing my A-levels, like English and history, absolute shoo-in, and I had the whole, if you study politics, then you can become a serious man, but if you study art, who knows? And my art teacher tried, it was sort of like transfer deadline day, he was trying to persuade me that I could do it, and I went for politics because I had my dad's sensible head in, and I always wonder what would have happened if I'd have ended up learning art with Mr. Crow. I imagine I would have been dead at 28 through methylated spirit poisoning.
Or maybe so, the other way around, you'd be prime minister right now.
Oh, you're saying that the being in the dark timeline goes all the way back to my choice of A-levels.
You were the turning point. You were the nexus at which 2016, Trump, coronavirus and everything else that's happening in the world happened, all because you didn't listen to the teacher trying to make you choose an art subject.
But that is an extraordinarily full-on visitation from the future. Thank you. Thank you, Barry.
But before we get into your full list of crimes.
Yeah, this, like, basically, having said that, I'm expecting a good angel to turn up and stop me jumping off the bridge and say that I do believe in fairies. Anyway, it is time to welcome our guest. And this week, it's an extraordinarily special guest because it is one of you guys. It is a Patreon donor who has parted consistently with their hard-earned cash. I mean, I've made a value judgment there. Who knows? They might just do it by being a landlord. But let's pretend it's it's hard-earned.
Maybe it's inherited wealth.
Yeah. Yeah, if any of you out there do have inherited wealth and aren't donating, really do sort that shit out. And it is time to introduce them. She was born and raised on the island of Samsø in Denmark that we have just learned in the show preamble is an island that looks like it's being sneezed out the head of the island of Denmark. Have a little look on Wikipedia and you'll see what we mean. She was raised in an old, very conservative church that her hippie parents turned into a pottery studio, and she currently attends law school at Copenhagen University. She had an all-action 20s where she got married, got divorced, lived in Texas for 8 years, worked in a mental hospital that, after she left, ended up being the set where Robert Rodriguez shot his hospital scene in the slasher movie Machete. She lost everything, nothing to do with a machete, came back to Denmark, found a partner, married him, and now lives there. She is named after a Viking fertility goddess, but wonderfully, that is a name that most Danes call their dog. So it is the equivalent of us welcoming on a British guest called Fido. By the sound of her, the look of her in her CV, she honestly couldn't be more Danish if she rode up to this podcast on Sleipnir and then pulled up a seat at the bottom of Yggdrasil whilst serenading the brothers Laudrup. It is a delight to welcome another Patreon guest, honoured listener, and the tuneful Nordic melody for the next hour, Sif Boynton. Hello, Sif.
Thank you. That was fucking wonderful.
I've been forgetting Machete. Why didn't they just film your life story there?
Oh, God. And you want to hear the worst part about that? That's actually where we had our, you know, admin building, where they shot Machete. It was just so fucking boring, you know, just paper pushers. I think the window he jumps out of with the entrails, you know, like very gory. It was the where we went and got clothes for people. So boring.
The glamour of filmmaking. Was that what you were trained to do, though? You're in law school now.
No, they give you a 3-week course and go, here's some keys and good luck.
Wow.
Welcome to America.
You've got the qualifications you need. If, to be fair, anyone who has a big, heavy key ring of keys has all the authority over me. Having gone to a boarding school, anyone who's got like a heavy key ring of keys could just shake them.
It clangs so nicely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And how are you coping in lockdown? What is the, as our Danish correspondent, what are the current rules and regs for you guys?
Well, we've been pretty lucky. Actually, the reason I'm on my island, normally I live in Nørrebro in Copenhagen, which is the northern part, kind of immigrant area of Copenhagen, but we were going absolutely fucking crazy. And before I started murdering my partner and everyone else, we went to my island and been here for a month. And we'll be here for another month.
Samsø, where you live, it's got a bit of an interesting Viking history. From the little bit of reading I did, it was sort of like a waypoint, a meeting point for various Viking ships.
The name basically means the island of gathering. And actually, it has one of the earliest known examples of a cross-country channel.
Like a canal.
The Kanhæve Canal.
Bless you.
So, yes, I know. Welcome to Danish.
like I've always thought that like a lot of the Scandinavian languages, but particularly Danish, it sounds like English, but coming through a portal from another dimension.
No, it's just like putting a potato in your mouth.
Yeah. Now, Sif, we always ask our guests on this show what they are worst at in the world, and what would that be for you?
Conflict of any kind will give me complete week-long anxiety.
Oh, wow. Then you have had your Viking blood hugely diluted over the past 1,300 years.
In certain scenarios, like if you fuck with my valuables, I will fuck you up. I'm pretty sure there's still a jeweler in Texas that you know, have nightmares about me. But I don't like conflict, you know, and we all wish we, you know, I don't know if you've heard about the Milligram experiment. Yeah, you know, I wish I could say I would be one of those brave souls who wouldn't electrocute some poor bastard to death. Yeah, no, I'd probably do it.
Is that out of politeness?
Yeah, I think I'm very polite. I'm very like, oh, no, don't offend anyone.
Yeah. I mean, that's generally a rule to live by, but I'd say the Milgram experiment, you're certainly offending the subject.
Oh, I would say anytime you electrocute someone to death, it might be offending.
Yeah, they might take issue with it.
That's why, you know, if we still had the death penalty in Britain, the last words that any of the victims would hear would just be the executioner going, terribly sorry. But I do like the thought of having you on the show, as, again, it's all about heroic failure, and you are the world's politest Viking, which is both on brand for the podcast and also the name of a children's book that I'll be writing as soon as this recording is over.
I'll apologize nicely after I put the axe in your head.
Yeah. As a respected and highly donating donor, Seif does get to judge the outcome of this episode as well. So she will be literally mulled to Ben and Mai's appeals as we go forward with the world's worst law. Ben, you're going to start us off.
Tens of episodes back, you talked about, I think, the man on the Clapham Omnibus.
Yes.
There's a particular phrase in English law. I don't know if there's an equivalent in Danish or American law, Seif, but it's basically the everyman is what it means. And I looked at other interesting and odd phrases in law, and my favourite one that I found was the moron in a hurry test. And that is all to do with trademark infringement or passing off, in which a hypothetical person who is the moron in a hurry, and the expression is used to reject a claim that two items could reasonably be confused by a passerby, and that only a moron in a hurry would be confused.
So like those off-brand Disney movie knockoffs you get at the counter in Tesco and so on, where it's like, it looks like the cover of Tangled, but it's called, you know, Intertwined or something. Yeah. And they've done the exact same sort of colour palette and everything, but it's just not the same film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Fantasia.
Yeah.
It was first used pretty late on in history. It was used in 1978, first used by Mr. Justice Foster in the case of the Morning Star Cooperative Society, that is the very left-wing newspaper, versus the Express Newspapers Limited, in which the publishers of the Morning Star sought an injunction against the Express for launching a new tabloid called the Daily Star. And the judge ruled against the commies, saying that if one puts the two papers side by side, I for myself would find the two papers are so different in every way that only a moron in a hurry would be misled.
High standards.
Yeah. I am married to a lawyer, so well done me.
Tax lawyer. The best time.
When I'm... met her, I thought tax lawyers were going to be like in suits, and they were going to be the backstabbing, high-flying, high-faluting, sleek, sharky, amoral lawyers. No, that's the corporate lot. They're the pricks. whereas tax lawyers, they're just the maths nerds.
In my school, everyone's like, oh, people that study tax law, holy shit.
They're the sort of people who, if it was World War II, they'd be recruited to Bletchley Park. They are.
They would crack the Enigma code.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Charge you for it.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Yeah, God, thank goodness it was the British who cracked the Enigma code, because that's what the Americans really would have done.
Yeah, monetize us.
Talking of America, I looked up an American law, the Guano Islands Act. Yeah, it's all about bird poo. Guano mania hit the United States in the 1850s.
100 years before Beatlemania.
Yeah, pigeons couldn't go anywhere. It was so embarrassing.
Welcome to the Ed Sullivan Vaudeville Show. And on the show today, we've got a pigeon ready to shit.
Yeah, and it led to like high prices and attempt to control the market and fear of resource exhaustion, and basically to make sure that the American economy didn't fly off the handle, the Guano Act enabled American citizens to take possession of unclaimed islands containing guano for the United States, and empowered the president to send in armed military to intervene. And this encouraged American entrepreneurs to basically sail out into the Caribbean and the Pacific to exploit tiny new deposits in islands and reefs and atolls, and then claim them as part of the burgeoning American empire.
All for shit.
All for shit. Over 100 islands have been claimed by the United States, going all the way down as far as Colombia, although the Colombian government not happy about it. And my favourite one, though, was that in 1964, Lester Hemingway, the brother of Ernest, attempted to establish a micronation that he dubbed the Republic of New Atlantis on a 8x30-foot bamboo raft with an engine block outside the territorial waters of Jamaica, and he tried to do that by using the Guano Islands Act as part of a claim to sovereignty.
Oh.
And his...
How drunk was he as a Hemingway?
Yeah, that was definitely a third bottle of rum idea, wasn't it?
Puts a whole new meaning to the old man of the sea.
Yeah. Yes, it does. His intention was to set up a new headquarters for his very own International Marine Research Society, where he planned to further research as well as to protect Jamaican fishing. However, neither America nor Jamaica recognized his claim before the raft was destroyed in a storm in 1966.
That's a very durable nation.
Yeah, it is.
It's his fault for naming it Atlantis, in fairness.
Yeah. He's asking for trouble. Yeah. Really asking for trouble. Next, I looked at people who sued God. In 1970, Arizonan lawyer Russell T. Tansey filed a suit against God on behalf of his secretary, Betty Penrose, seeking $100,000 in damages. Penrose blamed God for his negligence in allowing a lightning bolt to strike her house. When God failed to turn up in court, Penrose won the case by default.
So many of these courts are, you know, swearing, so help me God, and under God. So presumably they operate under Christian values. So God is omnipresent. Just because they couldn't see him doesn't mean he wasn't there.
Well, yeah, don't confuse the issue with facts.
Yeah.
Well, also, wouldn't the fact that you have to swear an oath on a book that God wrote, isn't that sort of leading the jury a little bit?
That would be a conflict of interest.
That's what I'm looking for, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah. I don't know if you have to swear on a Bible.
You can actually swear on anything as long as you swear to tell the truth on anything you hold sacred.
Yeah. If I am ever called as a defendant, I am definitely swearing on The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, God, me too. That book fucking changed my life.
Yeah. God, the Abrahamic God, is not the only deity to be sued. Chandan Kumar Singh, a lawyer from Bihar in India, sued the Hindu god Rama for mistreating his wife, the goddess Sita. The court dismissed his case, calling it impractical.
That a man is suing someone else for mistreating someone else's wife.
Well, if you see it, you gotta say it.
Yeah,
sorted.
That's true.
Let's keep in the worlds of religion. In Japan, there is an island called Itsukushima that is considered a sacred location in Shinto belief. And purity is of the utmost concern in Shinto worship. And because of that, the priests there have attempted to keep the island free of the pollution of death. Immediately after the Battle of Miyajima in 1555, which is the only battle to have ever taken place in the island, the victorious commander had the bodies of the fallen troops removed to the mainland and ordered that the entire battlefield be cleansed of the blood that was spilled, to the point that buildings there were scrubbed and blood-soaked soil was removed from the island. Since 1878, purity of the island and the shrine has been so important that no deaths or births have been permitted anywhere near it. So it is illegal to die or give birth next to the shrine of Itsukushima.
It's not the only place.
No, it's not the only place.
Yeah, I read there's the island of Delos in ancient Greece. Mm-hmm. That was another sacred island. And so the tyrant Pisistratus of Athens, he ordered all the graves within sight of the island's temple should be dug up and the bodies removed, so the dead people couldn't look at the temple, presumably, or vice versa. And then later on in the 5th century BC, after the Delphic Oracle said so, the whole island had all the dead bodies removed from it. And similarly, there are several places in France that have prohibited it. These are mainly because larger local government bodies have refused planning permission for graveyards. And so, because they then have nowhere to bury their bodies, they sort of enact these absurd laws to counter an absurd situation.
But human beings are just so logical.
Yeah, well, exactly. Similarly, there's one of those in Spain. There's a couple of myths around as well. Svalbard, the town of Longyearbyen in Norway, one of the last inhabited settlements north.
Yeah, Svalbard is actually an island.
Yeah, it's not illegal to die there. but they don't bury people there because there's no the permafrost.
It's too damn cold.
Well, the permafrost preserves the bodies, and so there are even concerns that some of the people who were buried there during the 1918 flu pandemic still contain traces of the 1918 Spanish flu.
Actually, how they were able to like find out what the 1918 was from Alaskan bodies that were buried and preserved in permafrost.
Yeah.
That's so how they figured it out.
And do you know about the House of Commons as well, Ben?
Yeah, it's you're apparently you're not allowed to die in the House of Commons, but that is apocryphal. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, seemingly so. And I read a piece from the Law Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Who have a list, who actually have a very entertaining website, we must post a link to it on Twitter actually, of all these laws which people might think are their laws and either confirming them or denying them. And they point out that while it's true that any death in a royal palace, of which the Palace of Westminster is one, falls under the jurisdiction of the coroner of the Queen's household, there is no legal obligation for a state funeral, which is one of the things that are considered, and there's no law against them being buried there, dying on the on those grounds. Four people are known to have died in the Houses of Parliament. Guy Fawkes and Sir Walter Raleigh, who were both executed in the palace grounds. Spencer Percival, the British Prime Minister, who was assassinated there. And Sir Alfred Bilson, who collapsed and died in the Eye Lobby during a vote in 1907. And there's a scene in the playwright James Graham's play This House, which revolves around this because the premise of it, it tells the story of the 1974-79 Labour government, which during the sitting of that government, I think they had a 20-seat majority when they started, and so many Labour MPs died over the course of the Parliament that they ended up not having a majority anymore. And they're like being forced to wheel in really ill members of Parliament to make sure they have as many people there to vote and all of that stuff. And there is a bit in it where they suggest, oh, one of them has to be brought over the bridge to St. Thomas's Hospital to be declared dead. You can't declare his place of death in the House of Commons. But as I say, that it is seemingly apocryphal.
But for my choice, I am going to stick in the United Kingdom. And it's just a really stupidly worded law that tickled me. And I think that is actually an appropriate phrase. I think the world's worst law is the Salmon Act of 1986, which regulates salmon fishery.
I think we've talked about this.
I don't remember it, but it is purely for these five words, because according to the Salmon Act of 1986, it is illegal to handle a salmon in suspicious circumstances.
And what constitutes suspicious circumstances?
Right?
Like, suspicious circumstances might be like a bank robbery. Maybe it like makes it a degree worse. Like, armed robbery is worse than robbery. Maybe salmon robbery. It's already suspicious. It's already suspicious you're robbing the bank. If you've got a salmon with you, it's aggravated.
I reckon that maybe it was after a member of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet watched the Monty Python fish dance and was like, no, I'm not having it anymore. I'm going to make that officially illegal.
Officially illegal?
This podcast is over.
How do you handle a salmon suspiciously? I mean, I can imagine, but I kind of don't want to.
Well, the question, of course, is who is suspicious about the way you're handling it? Is it another human going, I don't like the way he's got that fish? Or is it the other salmon going, what the fuck is he doing to Dave?
I really hope it's, you know, the salmon.
But I would say also in suspicion is so context-based. Because maybe to every like your friends, the idea of Ben wandering around with a salmon perched on his shoulder might be completely normal to me.
Well, yeah, well, that's it. As a lawyer, surely you want to go, no, my client was handling this salmon contextually.
Well, I mean, that's why this law can never be really, it's really bad, because, you know, you can't prove suspiciously.
No, you're right, because the loophole is if you're doing that bank robbery with the salmon, if you lift up the salmon, there's a tiny slice of brown bread underneath it. You're like, ah, ha, ha, ha.
To be fair, it's not just salmon that is covered under the Salmon Act. You can also handle, there are other fish that you could also handle a trout, eels, lampreys, or smelt. So
lampreys are suspicious. They've killed at least one English king.
At least
which English king did lampreys kill?
I think it's Henry the First.
Yeah, he died after Sir Peter Lamprey.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Sorry, I thought it was kind of like a bunch of lampreys ganged up on him.
No, it was the fish. He ate a bunch of fish and died.
It was Henry the First, and just the one of the first results I found is 1135. King Henry the First of England was known for his lust of eating the lamprey.
Now that is a gentleman who is handling a lamprey suspiciously. That's it. But the British Parliament very much shutting the stable door after the Holsters bolted 700 years earlier.
Straight back upstream to spawn yet again. Seif, let's hear what you have learned for us.
Oh, well, I looked at some really bonkers laws in the States, and there are some truly bonkers ones. Like, did you know, in California, you may have a frog jumping contest, but you may not eat it afterwards. Actually, the law verbatim says, any person may possess any number of live frogs, so that's good, to use in frog jumping contests. But if such a frog dies or is killed, it must be destroyed as soon as possible and may not be eaten or otherwise used for any purpose.
The thing that about all of these bonkers laws, and there are loads of them on the statutes in America, is if there's a law against it, someone at some point has done it.
As we've discovered from this podcast, the main problem with America is that it's so big that anything and everything can and will and often does happen.
What really worries me is the last phrase of the law. And this is an honest-to-God law. I'm looking at their website right now. It's the otherwise used for any purpose. That worries me. Like someone somewhere has used a dead frog for something not good. Something very, very not good.
I mean, I think you could probably get away with it if your excuse is, oh, my mouth was the finish line for the frog jumping contest.
True. I mean, I hear they're delicious.
Yeah, we've all heard the, oh, the dildo fell into my ass excuse. You know, the frog just accidentally hopped into my mouth.
Oh, I think it's in Nevada. You're not allowed to own more than 2 dildos. I'm not sure, but there's a law somewhere, and I think it's about it. You cannot own more than 2 dildos.
Surely, and maybe I'm showing my callow naivety here, surely 2 dildi is enough for anyone.
You would think.
But if you get smaller ones, like we've had wasp guns on this show in the past, Ben, maybe you get an ear dildo.
You know, maybe you need one that vibrates or one that, you know, rotates. You know, variation.
Until someone invents the Swiss Army dildo, we are stuck buying multi-purpose dildos. And the thing is, the tiny corkscrew you pull out of it is great because you can use it on pigs. I like the idea that they've gone, oh, you have to have, like, you can't have more than 2. They haven't stopped at 1, because in Switzerland, I believe, there's a law that say pets have to be in pairs. You can't have, like, a single hamster or a single rabbit. They have to have a second one. So I like the idea they've gone, oh, the dildo might get lonely. And yeah, in Italy, there's a lot of very sort of good animal protection ones in Italy, especially. You mentioned it. And apparently in Turin, dog owners are required to walk their dog 3 times a day. That's from 2005. Oh, yeah, it's a 500 euro fine if you don't do it. You're also banned from dyeing your pet's fur or any form of animal mutilation for merely aesthetic motives.
How can they keep tabs on how many times a day you walk your dog?
You get a watchdog.
I also found a law, and this is one that just I love. In Arizona, you're not allowed to keep a donkey in a bathtub.
That's the title of a Smiths song, isn't it?
Yeah. Donkey in a bathtub.
I know.
And the best reason for this is just it's utterly neighborly bitchiness. It was a farmer in 1924. This is when the law was made, and it still stands, as far as I can find out. Someone, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. And it was because a farmer had a bathtub on his property, and a donkey was sleeping in it. and there was a flash flood, and this whole town came out and tried to rescue this damn donkey in a bathtub. And afterwards, they're like, fuck this shit.
All the donkey should have done is just, you know, taking the plug out.
You would think, but, you know, the hooves.
I love that the fact, again, the lawyerly mind that I do not possess goes, okay, it's prohibited to have a donkey in a bathtub. I've now intuited that it is therefore legal to have a donkey in a shower.
Mm-hmm. What about a bidet? Can you have a mule in a bidet?
No, it's usually an ass in a bidet.
But I think one of my favorite bonkers laws is that in Idaho, it's the only, as far as I could find out, it's the only state that has an active no cannibalism law.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's only involuntary cannibalism. So supposedly, if you said good, you could be eaten.
So you can't, like, kidnap someone and eat them. But if someone says, yeah, eat me, it's fine.
Yeah, apparently. That's what I was reading. I mean, again, I could be wrong because a lot of these laws, you know, I was researching Danish laws, like, you know, and I was finding all these lists and, you know, bonkers laws in Europe. And apparently there's this one list where it says that in Denmark, if you find a child and the parents doesn't claim it within 2 hours, you get to keep it. That's obviously not true.
What?
Yeah, some list that says, yeah, apparently Danes are, you know, rampant child kidnappers.
Wow. But, you know, in Malta, up until quite recently, because it was considered you could mitigate a kidnapping if you married the victim afterwards.
Oh, no, there's tons of laws around that. I'm actually, like, looking at my notes right now.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of sort of marry your rapist, for want of a better term, solutions to rape trials. It's a lot of people sort of associated with the Middle East. It was in Latin America until the 1990s, and Malta, as I say, you were exempt from prosecution and punishment in an abduction if you went on to marry the abducted person. That was repealed sometime in the last 2 or 3 years.
But there are, especially in the Caucasus and all those STAN countries, I can't remember the specific one, where it's actually still a thing where they do bride kidnapping. And that's kind of, like, become a part of their, like, wedding traditions, where you just kidnap a girl.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, in a lot of places, it's, you know, it's arranged beforehand, but just the fact that you even have to do it, like, that's some fucked up shit.
Do you have a definitive worst, then?
Well, I mean, you know, I tried real hard to like, be, like, light and breezy, as one says. But there's just so many really fucking terrible laws. Like right now, or this was last year, we had this huge controversy with a masking law, which was called the burqa law. That's not what the law is actually called, which basically is a law to prohibit people from wearing face coverings in public. And it's not really meant to stop demonstrators, but it's more aimed towards Muslim women.
Yeah.
And what's, you know, that law, I think, is probably my pick because it's just so stupid. I mean, A, it doesn't work, which a law should fucking work. And B, it also does the exact opposite of what it's intended to do. You want to, you know, you can't oppress someone by oppressing them. And also, if they're so oppressed that they can't go outside without face coverings on, you're now preventing them from going outside. So
that is the best description I've had of why that law is bullshit. You can't oppress someone by oppressing them further. The law thinks that it is freeing someone up by dictating how they can or cannot dress, but actually it is being even more dictatorial.
Yeah, and again, you know, a lot of these women do it absolutely voluntarily. Yes, mm-hmm. Of course there are women who are forced to do it. But if they're so oppressed that they can't go outside without being completely covered up, and we're talking 40 women in Denmark, I mean, it's ridiculous how low this number is, then you're also stopping them from seeking help because now they're just stuck inside.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, if I want to fucking walk down the street naked, not that I want to or anyone wants to see, that's my prerogative. If you want to do the exact opposite, well, go the fuck ahead.
I think what it needs, and this is not just for women, it's for either gender, I think that the law needs to be amended. Face coverings should not be made illegal, apart from in certain circumstances where they should be made mandatory.
Yes, there are some ugly motherfuckers out there.
Correct.
And what I have, also what I have is like, in Danish, it's what we call symbolpolitik. It basically means, you know, a law that's symbolism. You don't do it to really enact change. It's just to look good.
Yeah. You know. Virtue signaling, legal virtue signaling.
And, you know, no one likes, you know, women being impressed. I mean, come on. But, you know, we also can't be on the wrong side. Also, it's unenforceable.
Yeah, it really is. Can I just also say, on a slightly lighter note, I was really hoping that we would get at least one Danish word that is sort of untranslatable into English out of you, and I'm delighted that I was right.
Oh, I can bring you a bunch of them. You have no idea the sayings we have in Denmark.
Oh, go on, like, give me a weird saying.
Der ule i mosen.
Mm-hmm. The oily moose.
No, there's owls in my quagmire.
Go on.
Which basically means something's up. Something's, oh, der ule i mosen.
Oh, I feel it in my waters. This, yeah, something's about to happen.
No, this is not right, you know? Or Dane men i skysovs,
which means
the man of the day in sky gravy.
The man of the day in sky gravy.
That is the literal translation. Dane men i skysovs.
And what does that entail?
It means you're the shit. You know, you're you know, it's, you know, you're the man of the day, basically.
But you're also in sky gravy. Well, pollution in Denmark must be so bad.
Can you be in sky gravy and have an owl in your quagmire all at the same time?
I don't think so. But, you know, my absolute favorite is one that, where in Danish it sounds like one thing, but in English it sounds just completely fucking wrong. And it's when you say it's when something's really good, like when you're just in a good place, you're sitting in the sunshine, you know, life is good, you're in smørhul. But that translates to being in the butterhole.
That's my happy place.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that I have an owl in my quagmire that your selection is going to be right up there as a contender for the world's worst law.
Well, that makes me Dane's many skusos.
Yeah.
In Scotland, you can't deny someone entry to your property if they need the wee. Yeah, if you really need the toilet in Scotland and they say, you know, you knock on someone's door, they have to let you in to use it.
In Arizona, you have to give them a glass of water.
Nice. Well, Arizona's quite, you know, quite dry, yeah. Well, I think we also talked about this. Since 1939, it's illegal to carry planks along the pavements in the UK.
Is that because a judge watched a car chase from the 1970s?
I think he saw the film with Eric Sykes and Tommy Cooper.
Yeah.
Off the plan, and was like, no, can't have any of the shenanigans. If you need the loo urgently in public, you can have a wee. There's no like state law against it. There might be local bylaws. And there is some, again, there's a lot of myths around some of these things. There is a myth that only men can wee in public and they have to urinate on the rear wheel of their vehicle or something like that with a hand on the car. That's one of those lists of crazy British laws that you might get in like the Mail or the Express or one of those papers or on BuzzFeed, and it's bollocks. You can wee wherever you like, assuming it's not prohibited under local bylaws, so long as there's a need for it. As long as you're not there standing outside an enemy's house forcing one out.
The only proper place to wee in public, honestly.
Yeah, it's only just it happens to be outside the front door of someone I really hate.
While handling a salmon.
Speaking of fish, sturgeon and indeed whales, they're considered royal fish in the UK. If you find a beached whale in the UK, you have to offer it to the reigning monarch.
Does the queen then have to ride down and formally turn it down?
You would hope so. I think she probably has a whale guy. because there's just, you know, she gets hundreds of these requests a day having to do it. That's why Nicola Sturgeon's surname is Sturgeon. It's like Baker or Chandler or, you know, Fletcher. It's one of those professions that her ancestors must have been.
That makes sense. Yeah, the groom of the whale.
Yeah.
Oh, to be the queen.
Most of us have to go to the sorting office and reject our whales in person. There is a myth that you can't put stamps upside down on an envelope. That's not true. There is a law, the Treason Felony Act of 1848 makes it illegal to take action to depose the monarch, but turning your stamp upside down is not one of the ways in which you can do that.
But if you do turn your stamp upside down, then the Hell Queen is the one who posts it.
From 1541 until 1960, the Unlawful Games Act required every Englishman between the ages of 17 and 60 to keep a longbow and regularly practice archery.
Yeah, that's a classic.
That's a good one. That one is a real thing. And in 1562, there was the Articles for the Execution of the Statutes of Apparel, passed under Elizabeth I, prohibited anyone from appearing at the royal court wearing shirts with outrageous double ruffs or hose of monstrous and outrageous greatness.
You still also can't wear a suit of armour in Parliament.
That's true as well, yes.
Yeah, Jacob Rees-Mogg is furious about that.
At any time. It's illegal to be drunk in a pub.
What?
Section 12 of the Licensing Act 1872, every person found drunk on any licensed premises shall be liable to a penalty. It's also an offence under the Metropolitan Police Act of 1839 for the keeper of a public house to permit drunkenness on his premises, and under the Licensing Act of 2003, it's an offence to sell alcohol to a person who is drunk. So they've really trebled down on that.
Yeah, well, if they've trebled on it, then they've got the inspiration from the big market in Newcastle.
Yeah. It's also an offence under Section 28 of the Town Police Clauses Act of 1847 to willfully and wantonly disturb people by ringing their doorbells or knocking at their doors.
You can't play Knockdown Ginger.
You can't play whatever in your local area you call that thing where you knock on people's doors and run away. Nick Knocks, or whatever it is that you're calling it.
That's a damn shame.
Yeah, damn shame, I say. And there's another one of these laws that, again, it probably isn't true, that it's an offence to allow your own pets to engage in mating rituals with a pet from the royal family. Without
hands
permission.
Off the Queen's corgis.
Yeah, if you're out for a walk and the Queen's out for a walk and your dog starts humping her dog, you're basically, you can be executed.
To the tower.
Yeah, it's probably, again, not true. The Law Commission can't find that anywhere on the statute books.
I was about to say, what if the corgi has an orgasm?
Then that's, I think they have to marry and then it's fine.
Yeah.
Then that led me to read some more animal laws. It's illegal to drink and ride a horse.
Fair.
Can't drink and drive, can't drink and ride. Owners of pigs in France are forbidden from calling them Napoleon. Yeah, George Orwell missed that memo, apparently. And I like this one. According to Cape Cod Online, in 1711, the town of Truro, Massachusetts, passed an order that every single man in the township, and that's single as in unmarried, shall kill 6 blackbirds or 3 crows and shall not be married till they comply with this requisition. Because apparently at the time, crows and blackbirds were destroying corn crops. And so they passed this law tied to marriage to try and cull the population of pests.
So basically, if you want to get laid, kill some birds.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, fair enough.
Be like nowadays, if you say, you know, Ben, you want to get married in 3 months, you've got to kill 100 pigeons.
I could do that in an afternoon. Yeah. Not a problem. give me your baseball bat and 4 bottles of beer, and I will. Yeah.
It's probably a sport somewhere, in fairness. And then I read some family laws. It's a crime to forget your wife's birthday in Samoa. It's a crime in your household as well, isn't it, Ben?
Yes, it is.
It's a crime in every household.
Yeah. Apparently, it's illegal for a husband to scowl at his wife on a Sunday in Detroit, Michigan.
Who is the Scowlmaster General who is going round checking this out?
Do they have one of those? Isn't there, like, there's that facial expression chart for children when they might be about to be sick? Like, there's a thing, I can't remember what it's called, but there is a chart with, like, different levels of pain that your child is expressing, if they're non-verbal, of what, you know, to describe to a nurse or a doctor over the phone. So presumably there's someone in Detroit goes around with, like, 6 different smilings, a chart of smiling to frowning faces walking past every couple. with a taking out a protractor and measuring the angle of the corners of your mouth. And in Wichita, in Kansas, there's a law that makes it compulsory to be nice to your mother-in-law.
Wow, I imagine mother-in-laws in Kansas might be right jackasses if they need to have a legal backing for being nice to them.
But I've come to more serious laws. There's a law in the Irish Constitution, Article 41.2, which is up for a referendum hopefully sometime soon, which states, in particular, the state recognises that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state shall, therefore, endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home.
Wow.
Yeah, that's still in the Irish Constitution, written in the 1930s, but with a lot of input from the Catholic Church.
So basically, mammies are in your constitution.
Yeah, and you know they, you know, their place within the home and her life within the home and their duties in the home are enshrined.
Does that mean if we can get that part of the constitution abolished, then Mrs. Brown's boys will have no legal footing to exist?
That is the essential reason behind this campaign. Good. To have a referendum.
Good.
That's a pretty bad one.
But in light of what's been happening in America this week, I have decided to look at the Three-Fifths Compromise. We're recording this on the Tuesday, what date is it? The 2nd of June, which is the day after Donald Trump gassed peaceful protesters so he could have a photograph outside a church.
It's going to hell in a handbasket, let me tell you.
Yeah, I mean, the church, I imagine maybe the church had actually initially caught fire because Trump actually tried to go into it the night before and it just like, no, repelled him.
You know, basically they're like, no, got to burn instead of having the orange shirt, idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, surely Joe Biden, all he's got to do for an attack ad is have the words, the power of Christ compels thee.
You would hope so. America obviously has deep-seated history with slavery and racism, which... Well, better people than us can educate you on, and we've been posting on our Twitter today several resources for that, and just go and find some much better podcasts to deal with that than this. But I thought it was worth discussing the Three-Fifths Compromise, which maybe a lot of our British listeners won't be aware of. This is Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution, which read, and indeed still reads, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to the respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons, and by all other persons it meant slaves. So the common understanding of this law is that it basically counted slaves as 3/5 of a person. That's not quite what it meant. And the reason it was brought in was during the 1787 U.S. Constitutional Convention. They were arguing about how to determine legislative representation and taxation and stuff, and what level of the population would be used to apportion seats in Congress and all of those things. And the largely southern slave states argued that actually they wanted to count all of the slaves, not because they valued slaves, but because they would get greater power in Congress. And almost weirdly, the northern states were arguing that they shouldn't count slaves in apportioning this because they didn't want the slave states having a greater influence. And not only that, but they didn't want to encourage the slave trade by having, you know, them import more and more and more slaves to try and up their representation.
It's one of those
odd thing.
Weird counterintuitive things where actually by, at the time, denying them basic human rights was a way of trying to stop these horrible states have power.
You would get basically one seat for every 1,000 people in the population, but that 1,000 could include 3/5 of the slave population of your state. So it's not that every slave is 3/5 a person, that you could include 3/5 of slave population in topping up your numbers. The compromise was proposed by Delegate James Wilson and seconded by Charles Pinckney. And Pinckney was particularly one of those who said he wanted all persons counted because he knew that slaves couldn't vote anyway. So giving, you know, including them didn't mean anything to the slaveholders. The agreement set the census value of a slave at 60% of the value of a free person. And this lasted until the 13th Amendment was passed, which ended slavery. The 14th Amendment granted full citizenship, and 15th Amendment granted the right to black men to vote. And obviously, and then everything has been fine since then. Exactly. But I read a really interesting article as an aside to this, written by a guy called Theodore R. Johnson, who's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and adjunct professor at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. In 2015, he proposed reparations, which if people should read Ta-Nehisi Coates' article about the argument for reparations, which suggests reimbursing the families and descendants of slaves for the ingrained injustice that their families have ancestors suffered and that they, by descendants, have suffered. Johnson argues that basically the American public aren't on board with the idea of free money, which is what they boil down reparations to in that sense. So he argues that perhaps a better reparation would be to invert the ratio and give black Americans 5/3 of the vote.
That is both ingenious and a real thumb snuck at modern America.
It is excellent.
It's well, not least because one Twitter thread I was reading last night or the night before, talking about the last election, going, when it comes to elections, and actually I've got a friend over here who talks about British elections the same, like, when it comes to voting, black people, from a progressive point of view, do their job. They vote for the Democrat Party, they vote for the Labour Party. It's white people, and generally speaking, white men. But last time for Trump, both white men and white women voted majority for Trump.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's yeah.
Well, his suggestion was that you would enforce this for maybe 24 years. So that gives it a lot of cycles in American elections, which would make the people standing for election, whether they were black or not, have to focus on trying to court a large proportion of the black vote. He points out that in 2015, the median household wealth for white people was $141,900. For black people, it was $11,000. Despite making up only 13% of the population, black Americans are 27% of those living at or below the poverty line. The white unemployment rate was 4.6%. It was 9.6% for black people. During the housing bubble, 53% of black people received high-cost mortgages compared to 18% for white people. The black incarceration rate is 2,207 per 100,000 compared to a national rate of 707 per 1,000, with nearly 3 in 4 black children attending segregated schools.
Now, there's a huge disparity between, you know, the black American experience and the white American experience. And it's, you know, people that think that racism is not alive and well in America, it fucking is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's ridiculous. I mean, I lived in Texas. It's a southern state. I've seen it, you know.
Yeah. And I don't.
It's insane.
And I don't say I don't make the argument that Britain or Ireland or anywhere else is any better, but for a nation that holds itself up as a shining beacon on a hill and has been struggling with this for far too long after they've fixed it and then fixed it and then fixed it and it's still broken.
It was never really fixed. I remember when I was a kid, I went to an American high school in Poland, and we read To Kill a Mockingbird in eighth grade. And part of, you know, if you read that book, it part of the plot is that there's a black man who's accused of raping a white woman. And it's the scary black man, you know. And this book was written, you know, 50 years ago. I'm not quite sure. And we're still fucking here, you know. Yeah. It's the same fucking story, the scary black man. And it's tiring.
Yeah. Johnson in his article also says, oh, people are going to say, but what about one person, one vote? And he points to Evanwell versus Abbott, which was a case the Supreme Court were looking at, which was basically about how you determine a district size. Should it just be for total population or the total population of eligible voters? Because you can have a district with a huge number of ineligible voters, children and undocumented immigrants and transient military personnel who count towards the representation rights of that district. So that isn't one person, one vote. Not only that, the US Senate, Delaware has just as much say as California, even though California has many more times the population. The House of Representatives, Montana, has one member for its population of 1 million people, while Rhode Island's second congressional district has just 525,000 constituents, but also has a member. And you've the Electoral College, which doesn't boil down to one.
That system just doesn't work. And then you have, you know, what I think some of the things you were describing was, you know, the practice of gerrymandering.
Yeah.
Where you, you know, redraw congressional lines to suit your needs, basically.
Yeah. So for obvious reasons, and just as an example of one of, you could go through history and find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, but it seemed like a very pertinent example of human beings making laws to degrade and demean our fellow human beings. So I'm putting forward the Three-Fifths Compromise. Not funny, but relevant.
I agree. Very relevant.
So our three candidates for the world's worst law are... It's a real mixed bag, guys. Ben's suggestion of the Salmon Act of 1986. Steve's suggestion of the Burqa Laws. An umbrella term for calling the Burqa Law seems fairly on the nose.
Technically, and, it's a masking law, but let's call it duck a duck, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And my suggestion of the Three-Fifths Compromise dating back to the American Constitutional Convention. And Steve, as... the judge on this episode, you have the fun job of having to decide which of these things is the worst thing.
Can I just make the point that I'm not going to stand up for the salmon law unless you decide to basically degrade two of the legal pillars of the most controversial topics of our times. But respect you, C, for bringing a law about a woman's independence to choose how she lives her life, and Barry for bringing something that is the most important news topic at the moment. And yet I, a Jewish man, didn't bring the Nuremberg laws. And I just want a little bit of credit. Someone remembered that this is a comedy podcast first and Newsnight second.
Well, how about we give you an honorary, you know, just for that.
Yeah, we'll give you a little tiny gavel and a wig of your own, and you can go and play in the corner.
Thank you.
You know, I mean, of course, one is want to, you know, pick oneself, but I actually think I'm going to pick you, Barry. I think yours is more apropos of right now, and yours also kind of does the same thing what I'm describing. You know, it oppresses. I mean, any law that oppresses people, and your law is, you know, what your suggestion is also much more far-reaching. It's not just about women, and it's not just about covering up. It's so far-reaching. So I think you win.
Yeah,
I would say yay, but I don't feel like celebrating that victory.
No, and also, as the chat we had at the end of your section suggests, what you've really done, you think the world's worst law isn't just the Three-Fifths law, it's basically all of America. We basically need to delete America and start again.
Is there a control alt delete button somewhere up in, you know, Alaska?
Yeah, no, if you push down Florida, Rhode Island and Alaska at the same time, if they all have earthquakes, and then it basically resets all of America.
You know what, that's the sad part also about the American Constitution. Part of it was just huge compromises, and they basically went, we'll fix it later.
Yeah, well, on a cosmological time scale, they could still have time.
You know, honestly, maybe you should win, Ben. You know, I mean, suspicious salmon handling.
Yeah.
Again, you'll get a special prize, but Barry, I think you win.
Before we go, I should give you some of the best news of the week.
Yeah.
Trying so hard. I feel like it would be trivial to sort of look beyond the good news that people seem to be finally waking up and channeling energy and frustration into a centuries-old problem that just it comes around. As sure as eggs are eggs and the sun also always rises, we just get the same old... story of these police brutality and endemic racism in the US. And I found one, there's so many bright stories of, you know, there are some lovely interactions between cops and protesters. There's some brilliant resources and stories being told and shared. There is a very reassuring outbreak of humanity among certain sections around the world. And there was one little story that, in the midst of it all, that I thought was worth noticing, that Grindr, the gay hookup app, has removed its ethnicity filter in an act of support for the Black Lives Matter movement, something which has been long overdue. Basically, if you're using Grindr, you could say, I want to look for people between this age and this age and in this area and so on. And they have for the longest time said, I don't, you can tick it to not show you Asian people or not show you Black people or not show you such and such a thing. And so they have pulled their fingers out, for want of a better word, and decided to do away with that. I mean, as there's a lot of very, very overdue shutting of stable doors after the horse has been long bolted from many companies and corners. But hopefully it's that arc of history bending ever so slowly towards right. We will also be, as I'm sure you'll have seen, sharing other stuff on the podcast thing. But we're also going to do our best to try and make things happy and cheery.
Yeah,
because we can't overstate our platform, but it would also be remiss of us not to use it in some way. And to be fair, if you're listening to the show and you are a racist and you've gotten 160 odd episodes in, just stop listening. I don't know how you've gotten this far. How have you put up with this?
Self-punishment. It's just, you know, like it's like a monk beating themselves.
Yes, I would hope we don't have to tell you how to not be racist, but as in the words of lots of the memes going around at the moment, maybe work harder at being anti-racist if that is something that you feel able to do.
I agree.
Seif, where can people find out more about you and what you're doing if they want to follow you on social media and so on?
Nowhere. I am,
you're a will-o'-the-wisp.
I have an Instagram. I post like pictures and then I delete them as soon as I post them. Because, you know, what's the fun of actually having a media presence when you can be elusive and mysterious? You can check out my... Yes. You can check out my very good friend and ex-husband's guitar business in Austin. It's called Paul Sherry Guitars. He is amazing. And also my mom. She's a potter here in Samsur and Seal Holman Pottery. So, nice. Yeah, those are the two people I want to shout out because they're fucking talented as shit.
Nice. Well,
again,
go check them
like
out. That's all right. We're delighted that we had you on board our ship today. Meanwhile, we're all off to tickle a kipper in a slightly threatening fashion. Thank you for listening to Westward Forward. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.